Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is episode 12, Education Before Liberation. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. One of my favorite things about working with teachers and students from around the world is their stories. Stories about tragedy and triumph, struggle, sacrifice, and ultimately success. I'm so humbled by ordinary people who courageously make a difference. And as always, I'm eager to share their stories with you. In today's episode, we feature two extraordinary educators whose remarkable stories span countries and continents and bridge barriers. Both of these individuals are Freedom Writer teachers that hail from the beautiful country of South Africa. They talk about growing up under the apartheid regime, fighting for freedom, and the power of education to deliver the promise of democracy. First, we'll hear from Dr. Nomsa Galletta, who is also one of the co-authors of the book Teaching Hope, Stories from the Freedom Writer Teachers. Next, we have our Diary of the Day segment, where you'll hear an excerpt from Nomsa's entry from our book, Teaching Hope. She writes about an experience that helped her students turn a tragedy into a rallying cry for justice and democracy. Then we have our featured discussion with Dr. St. Clair Adrian, who talks about the discrimination prevalent during apartheid and his origins as a student activist. St. Clair then takes us from his protests in the streets of South Africa, crying for Nelson Mandela's release from prison, to his journey as an educator in America who is committed to the practice of restorative justice. As you listen to this episode, I hope you feel inspired and invigorated to use education to bring about greater freedom for all. Now, here's Nomsa joining us by phone today from Maryland.
I grew up in Durban, South Africa. That is where my childhood was, and that is where my education and teaching was. It is an interesting story because apartheid means separation, separated in all aspects of your life by race. The president then had declared that a black person in South Africa must have an education that will never make him believe that he will be more than a servant in white people's homes. So that is how I was born, and I was born into that kind of environment. We knew that as blacks, we would never have the life that a white child would have, the education a white child would have, the medical care that a white child would have, would never have the food that they have. It was just plain as that. I remember I may have been 9 years old, and we went to a church-related event. Everybody was sleeping in tents or outside in the grass, but there was a designated area for whites where they could have beds and a place with an air conditioner. And I asked my father, why are we separated? Why are we not all here sweating together? Well, my father tried to explain in a way that would not traumatize me, but I remember that conversation very vividly. That is when I realized there was something very wrong. I was lucky both my parents were educated. They were both teachers. My grandmother had a sixth grade education. That was the highest she could have gone. But both sides, my grandparents were wise enough to know that education would free my parents as kids. Education was equal to freedom. When I was growing up, we listened to BBC News because we would get all the news and get all the politics, and they would tell us why. So I knew that something was happening in Africa when the countries became free of colonization. Democracy to me means an ability of people to have a say in their government, to have a say in how their lives are run, have a say in their education, that freedom to be part of the conversation and have a responsibility to make it happen. It means the freedom to think, the freedom to do, the freedom to become, the freedom to challenge, the freedom to be part of the solution, the freedom to be a disruptor where you feel something is wrong. For example, when I was teaching in high school, I would go home very exhausted because I would put apart in little pieces the curriculum of the whole country. I knew that there was something really wrong, but I didn't know how to put it back together. They had clustered the curriculum in such that when Black students graduate with honors, they go to universities, they are not admissible in programs that they wanted to take because the curriculum was designed so that it's the bottleneck, they can't do it. And when the opportunity became available for me to leave, I said, I will be a curriculum expert, which I did, so that I can pull it together so that Black students who are educated can be accepted in universities and be able to pursue their chosen career. If we could teach our children to be unafraid and have a thirst for learning that never ends, that would be the best. I don't want our kids to be afraid, to never dream, to feel there is a limit because of who they are. If just one child would see themselves in my journey and say, I can take the journey, I can do it, I would know that my job has been done. I would die a happy person.
Like NOMSA, our hope is that every teacher, every student, and everyone listening to this podcast never has to feel limited because of the color of their skin or the country of their origin. It's time for our diary of the day, diary number 100 from our book, Teaching Hope. The entry will be read by freedom writer Tanya Payne.
Moses was from Soweto, an outsider in my classroom. He wanted everyone to know that he was in charge, that he could solve all his problems by himself, with his knife if necessary. Moses was a quick stabber, so I kept my eye on him. To me, Moses embodied the anger and frustration resulting from apartheid, the slogan that had taken root in the struggle against the system, democracy now and education later, resonated with my students. The teachers, though all Black, were overwhelmed or had given up long ago. I refused to give up, knowing that my inaction would only perpetuate the system we all reviled. Remember to review your notes on chapter 8, I reminded my students as the bell rang. I collected my books and put away my belongings, unaware of Moses, who was still slowly packing his book bag. Then I heard his raspy voice behind me. Miss, take this. He handed me a 9-inch knife. I want to change, he stuttered without looking at me. All right, I hesitated to take it. I will keep it for you only if you promise not to get another one. He looked me straight in the eye and without hesitation said, I promise, and swiftly left. That Saturday, I got a call from Rita. Miss, he is gone, she whispered. They killed him. Who is gone? I asked, dreading the answer. Moses was killed this morning. I felt as if the bottom of my stomach had dropped to the floor. Monday morning, I did not know what to say to my students. Then a student stood up, strong and tall, and said, we've got to stop the crazy killing. Democracy now and education now.
Even through great difficulty, NOMSA helped her students emerge from the tragic death of Moses to create positive change. Some of you who are teachers may have experienced something similar, the loss of a student, and have seen how it can affect you and your students far beyond the classroom walls. To make a difference in the lives of struggling students, it requires a community of like-minded educators who can support, encourage, and inspire. That's why we host our Freedom Writer Teacher Institutes, to provide educators, like our guest, NOMSA and St. Clair, with the tools and the relationships they need to return to their classrooms feeling like they are a part of something bigger. We believe that every teacher can find and fulfill their purpose. If you're interested in learning more about our institutes and becoming a Freedom Writer teacher, send us an email at fwi@freedomwritersfoundation.org. We are here to teach one to teach another. Now it's time for our featured discussion. Joining me today at the Freedom Writers Foundation is principal, activist, and Freedom Writer teacher extraordinaire, Dr. St. Clair Adrian. I am honored beyond belief to be sitting with an esteemed teacher, not just in America, but hailing from South Africa. He is far too modest to ever reveal that he was the Disney Teacher of the Year and also turned down Oprah to run her South African Academy. He had bigger plans and bigger dreams. So I want to introduce my beloved Freedom Writer teacher, St. Clair. So St. Clair, tell us where you were born, and I would love for you to talk about labels in Africa that may be different than labels in America.
So I was born in 1966 during the apartheid era in Port Elizabeth, South Africa. And where I come from is very close to where Nelson Mandela was born in Umtata in the Transkei. So apartheid became a policy in South Africa in 1948. So everything was segregated, including schools, beaches, restaurants. Everything was segregated. There was three distinct race groups: white, black, and then colored. And that's the race group that I identified with, were your mixed race, your Muslim people, your Indian people. So the brown skin was referred to as colored. The blacks was referred to as black, and then obviously the Caucasian people as white. And the white minority was in charge of the country, and then being black and colored, we were the two groups that felt the brunt of apartheid discrimination and injustice. So all the colored people lived in one area, all the black people lived in one area, and all the white people lived in one area. A lot of signs indicating where we could and where we could not go, could not eat, could not swim, and everything else that goes with that.
Did the signs actually say whites, blacks, and colored only?
Most of it was whites only, and what we could use was referred to as non-white, non-whites only. Apartheid was a master plan because there was very little interaction. Stereotypes was rife amongst each race group. But what was amazing was the way our parents protected us and how, without saying much, they made sure that we did the right thing, we said the right thing, until you get to that age where you understand something's wrong here.
As a child, was there forms that you had to fill out, that you had to check a box, or what did that look like for children today that may not know what that feels like to have to check a box?
Right. Yeah, you had to check a box. And then when you turned 18, you became eligible to get an identification document. And in this document, colored people, in your identification number, there was an 01. And the 01 referred to colored. 00 was a white person. Up until democracy, you know, everyone knew if they looked at an ID, an 01 was a colored person. And that's the same way we were kept out of certain jobs, because there was mandatory conscription for whites when they turned 18, but not for people of color like myself. And so in order to keep us from getting certain jobs, the job requirement was must have completed military training. And that meant like we didn't do that. So yeah, don't apply.
When is your first memory of racism?
You know, there's a few things that happened to me as a child. But the one thing that stands out is we were at the roadhouse. South Africa, we had a bunch of roadhouses, which is like, if you think driving, but this time like a restaurant. And so as colored people, we were allowed there. We couldn't go up to the window or go inside to sit inside. And my dad had just bought this beautiful, beautiful yellow BMW. And we were standing there and the car next door pulled up. It was a white family and they had a little kid inside the family who really liked the car. And the kid said, "Whoa, Dad, look at this awesome BMW." And the dad looked across and our windows were down and clear as day we could hear. So in South Africa, the derogatory word to refer to someone colored is hotnot. So the dad said, "Oh, those are hotnots. They must be selling illegal liquor." And I'd never forget that day because my parents had to explain to, my dad particularly had to explain to us that what actually was being said is colored people don't have BMWs. They must be doing illegal stuff in order to drive that car. That I'd never forget.
Wow. Let's go back to that moment because I think, you know, there's a cliche in America, sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you. And clearly words do hurt. So the fact that you remember that all these years later, tell me what that was like as a young boy to hear that name, the implications with that sentiment, and then how your father must have been so demoralized explaining to his beautiful boy what that meant.
Right. And so that word was often used against us. I remember during uprisings, I remember when that army soldier or policeman took you, grabbed you by the back and threw you in a van or was hitting you. There was no holding back of hot not. I'm going to get you. Hot not, I'm going to give you a place till Christmas to stay in jail, etc. So it was clearly, derogatory was clearly meant to hurt and was clearly meant to dehumanize us as a people. But as I said, it is amazing how our parents basically protected us and did everything to make sure that we never had that feeling of not being as equal as growing up later finding out what was really going on in our country.
South Africa experienced civil rights much later than America. So were you cognizant of what was happening in America and curious when is it going to come on our shore?
I mean, I think up until today, kids growing up, it's all about America, music, television. I was watching TV, the Capitol building was on and Washington, D.C. And I sat there and I spoke out loud and I said, "Wow, I really want to go there one day." And my mom heard me and she said, "There's no reason, my boy, why you couldn't get there. All you need to do is keep going to school." I was in elementary school, never thought deeper than that. But we were aware of Martin Luther King. In South African schools, we studied American history. So everything was known to us. And yes, what I appreciated is that America was on the front lines of pushing for apartheid to end, pushing other countries to put pressure on the then nationalist party to make changes. So we idolized America growing up.
Tell us about being a young African boy, knowing that Nelson Mandela was incarcerated for his beliefs.
So in primary school, you know, you started hearing about, when I was a child, Nelson Mandela. It didn't make much sense then. And then we got to high school and you become aware of things. You are sensitized to the injustice. You're sensitized to oppression. You are now fully aware of what apartheid means. And that is when I, in high school, became, with my friends, a student activist, fighting for the release of Nelson Mandela, who was incarcerated at the time. The slogan of the day, however, when I was growing up and in high school, was liberation before education. And fortunately for us and my community, my teachers, my school principal, Mr. Raymond Uren, who was an amazing leader, activist, it was instilled in us, education before liberation. Because if I can remember some of his words correctly, we didn't want liberated idiots. We realized the importance of education. Hence, we went to class, and at the end of the school day, we took to the streets.
me what it was like to be bold as a teenager. What were you going up against?
So today, when I hear the South African national anthem, Nkosi Sikelela Afrika, which is basically saying God bless Africa, it brings back these memories of how it was seen as wrong. It was seen as being dissident to the apartheid regime. Sese took to the streets. There was a lot of protests, a lot of marches. And I can tell you what it feels like to be shamrocked. I can tell you what it smells like when that tear gas canister gets thrown at you. I can tell you what it feels like to feel rubber bullets flying by you. I can also tell you what it's like to be spoken to as if you're a dog when they take you and throw you into the back of that police van. A very interesting story I have of my early college life during the uprisings. We were standing on the stoop when the police came by, and that was the time during uprising in 1985. And they stopped, went at me, took me, and threw me in the police van. And within a minute, we had about 6 to 7 of the aunts in the street in the police van too. And they refused to let them take me. My mom was there too. And as I was speaking to them, telling them to get out of the van and everything, they said, you take one of our children, you take us too. That's what Ubuntu is. It stands for, I am who I am because of you. It just points to the interdependentness of mankind. That's how I grew up, and that is how, after they saw that these ladies weren't going anywhere, they let me go.
Where did this inner activism come from? Was it nurture or nature?
So, you know, when you grow up in an area and you are the oppressed, you get to meet and learn a lot from people around you. But my dad has always been part of the Builders Union. And then he had an older brother who was a school teacher and also very active, fighting for the release of Nelson Mandela, fighting against the apartheid regime, and also mobilizing students and teachers as an activist. And so I learned a lot from them.
You have more degrees than anyone. You're still in school. Literally, I want you to tell the listeners, how many advanced degrees do you have? And the fact that you are continuing to get more is astounding.
Before I tell that story, I remember going home for a weekend. My university was in Port Elizabeth. My parents were staying in a South Coast town called George. I was a full-time professional student. And Sunday after lunch, I'm ready to go home. My dad says, my boy, can I speak to you in the room, please? What now? He sets me down and he runs it by me. He's like, your mom and I are very proud of you. Proud of all you have accomplished. Proud of you being at university and studying and studying and studying. But listen to me carefully, my boy. It's time you get a job. Stop the studying. We don't want you to retire when you leave university. So I went to school for a number of years. In South Africa, I got my diploma in elementary education and then went to University of Port Elizabeth, where I finished my undergrad and 2 postgraduate degrees. Then went to Rhodes University, where I did another postgrad degree, and then came to the States, finished a PhD, and I am currently doing my 7th degree, a master's in restorative justice.
7th degree. That's amazing. And when you think of kids who look at the Justice League or Marvel characters, your superhero trait is your brain and your ability to make education relevant. So what was it like to be the first gentleman with that delineation of colored, be in a community and a college that was purely Caucasian?
Right. So I actually yesterday sent out a message to a colored girl from my community called Vivian Levac, who is now Professor Vivian Levac, and this week will be presenting as one of 2 final candidates to become Vice Chancellor of the University of Cape Town.
Wow.
Vivian was the first person of color on one of our house committees at the university when we arrived. And there was very little participation from people of color, or we were at that stage, we were part of a quota system. But because of Vivian's involvement, we became involved in student life. We didn't just leave after classes like we did before because we felt this wasn't ours. At that stage in the 90s, apartheid was still rife. We only became a democracy in 1994. And then being able to become involved, getting elected as the first person of color to the student government, and then the first person of color to become student government president, I was able to unify a university because a system previously has kept us apart. We had our own biases against each other based on how we were raised because we didn't know better. But the more we got to know each other, the more we started to hang out with people of different races. I got to go to a farm for my first time, get a tractor. The first group of white guys that came to my house were able to say, wow, there's nothing different. Never forget, my mom prepared, you know, a feast, because always a lot of food in my house. And one of the dishes she made was lamb curry. And one of the white guys, my friends, because remember now, to me, it's a friend. To my parents, there's still a white man in my house. As he left, said, no, ma'am, this is the best curry I've ever eaten. And everyone that came to my house, my mom used to say, can you tell your auntie what that white boy said about my curry? It was a huge thing because a white boy said that my mom's curry was the best he's ever had. But the nice thing about that experience at the University of Port Elizabeth, now called Nelson Mandela University, was that we came together, was that we learned from one another. And my first white friend, her name is Liesl, and she is currently in New York. A lot of her friendship, her introducing me to her family, me going to her house, her coming to my house, me going to their uncle's farms, rid me of so much of the biases that I carried. Even I can go as deep as some of those entrenched hatred based on those beatings, based on that tear gas, based on that rubber bullet. When I got to university, when we started becoming friends, black, brown, colored, or all sides, we realized that we were all the same, and lifelong friendships were born out of that. And up until today, the families and friends that we met across the color line are still family, and they're still friends, and we became colorblind.
What I find so unique about your activism is when you left South Africa to come to America to teach, you deliberately chose schools that are vastly segregated based on geography and socioeconomics and ethnicity. So tell me about that experience of leaving apartheid in South Africa and then coming to America and seeing apartheid again in American schools.
First of all, I never forget who I am, where I come from, how I was raised. But what stands out about all that was having teachers, having a community that believed in me, that believed in us, that consistently told us the importance of education. And you growing up, it was like everyone in the street had the right to discipline you. Anyone in the street had the right to make sure that if they see you doing something wrong, to address that. So coming out of an urban background, I wanted to be that person that through who I am, through what I was able to become, be able to share with students that zip code does not determine destiny. what you were born into, color of your skin, socioeconomic status does not determine where you will end up. So I have dedicated my life to urban education and making sure that kids like me, kids that people want to give up on, know that whatever you set your mind to, you can achieve. It's not about being a victim. It's using what others are doing to you to put you down, to make you feel less of a person, to bring in laws, to build walls, whatever it is, as a motivation to keep going, to keep getting better, to keep learning, and to make sure that you never give up. My mom and dad, both not formally educated beyond middle school, their words to me as a child growing up was, "My boy, they can tell you where to sit, they can tell you where to eat, they can tell you where to swim, but they can never take away what you know." Keep learning.
I want every kid everywhere to hear these words. I want you to tell the story about the children you've chosen right now to teach and an incident that happened recently on a very profound day and a very painful experience. And you were able to take that pain and make it the entire school's purpose. Explain that to our listeners.
Wow, yeah. Never forget, it was Tuesday, February 28th. And we were taking our students to the Museum of Tolerance because our eighth graders were reading The Diary of Anne Frank, when one of my students came to me and said, if we could just wait a few minutes because one of my students is running a little bit late because they're having a problem. And I said, sure. Girl problems, hair, she's just getting ready. About 5 to 10 minutes later, the student Fatima arrived at school crying, based on what was going on in America, in our country, at this time, as a dad was dropping her off at school. He was arrested in her presence by ICE officials, and they were about to deport him back to Mexico.
And for those listeners that are not in America, can you explain what ICE stands for?
So ICE is basically, in layman's terms, the immigration police. They go after people that hate the word, referred to as illegals, etc. And in February, they came after her dad because, in retrospect, she remembered seeing them in front of her house when they left. And I saw this 13-year-old girl come up the stairs crying, in a panic, hurting. She did not know if she'll ever see her dad again. And I've been in the States for about 18 years, and it's been mellow and nothing dramatic politically. But within a few minutes, South African activist St. Clair was back. Because I had two options. Number one was to sit down, shut up, and let my kids and their families be hurt. Number two was to stand up and speak out and make sure that the kids know that I am there for them, that the school is there for them, and that we will not give up without a fight. So by that afternoon, we've mobilized the community, we've mobilized our school community, we've mobilized across religious lines. We had rabbis, we had imams from our Muslim community, and everyone came together in order to make sure that this family was not ripped apart. That evening, I was on my way and there to stop the van from taking him to Tijuana, Mexico, deporting him. We were ready to lie in front of those vans to make sure it didn't happen. And fortunately, we got a stay on that night, and we kept on fighting. There were rallies. I was back in the streets again. And today I'm happy to say that the family, based on the mobilization, based on the community coming together, was able to keep Fatima's dad in the country.
So I have this vision of this activist telling your students about those rubber bullets and the tear gas and the implications of lying in front of a van if need be. Tell me what that was like for you to explain your history to make it be a part of your students' history.
Yeah, got me a lot of street credit. They look at me and they know, see this guy, brown guy like them, speaks a little funny. But I always make sure that they know why I'm hard on them when it comes to education. And I make sure that I tell them the story by using myself as an example. So when there's no homework, when there's a problem, I can refer to, you know, I would not have been here if I didn't work hard. You know, that I could have been anywhere else. I could be on the streets right now. But education is what got me here. So they see and they know why education is important to me. They also know what apartheid is, and they're able to actually make connections between what's going on right now, make connections between apartheid and what happened in Nazi Germany, the Holocaust time. And with that schema, the question that many of them ask is like, all those things happened so long ago, why is it happening again?
I feel like you are channeling your inner Nelson Mandela. So in honor of that legacy, describe to our listeners, for you as an activist who emerged from apartheid, what would be your wish for America and our educational system? If you had a call to action about activism and real change.
Equality and justice are two of those words that I would like to see drive what education is, what education becomes, where each and every student, no matter race or creed, have the same opportunities, the same access to great teachers, great schools, great facilities. Nelson Mandela is obviously one of my biggest role models. That day, 11th of February 1990, when he was set free, I will absolutely never forget what he meant to us as a country, as our first black president, as a person who united all of us. What Nelson Mandela taught me, which will always be part of who I am, is forgiveness. When you spent 27 years in prison, when you have been shackled based on your beliefs by a certain group of people, and 27 years later you are able to forgive, 27 years later when you get inaugurated as president, you have the guard that stood outside your cell in prison be a part of that ceremony, means that you have forgiven and you are the epitome of greatness. I'm hoping through restorative justice to create a community and a school community where everyone feels they have voice and where we can find solutions by listening, understanding, and forgiving each other.
In honor of their truth, remember that zip code does not determine destiny. That concludes our show this week. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier with production assistance from Clay Amontorp. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with your friends and leave us a review. Help us spread the word, share hope, and most importantly, help us pass the message of freedom so that we can lift, we can learn, and we can live our stories to the fullest. Our call to action today is this. May we have a thirst for knowledge. May we create communities where everyone has a voice. And as our guest St. Clair Adrian affirms, may we remember they can never take away what you know. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told. Hi, folks. It's Erin Gruwell. Thank you so much for listening to the show. We're so grateful you keep coming back for more impactful stories from Freedom Writers, Freedom Writer teachers, and our extraordinary guests. This is just a friendly reminder that we have now switched to a bi-weekly release schedule for the summer. During our busy Teacher Institute season, we'll be bringing you episodes every other Monday instead of every single Monday. But stay engaged with us online to see what we're up to and keep an eye out for more substantive content. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And while you're there, leave us a comment or even send us a message. We look forward to staying connected with you and helping you make a difference.